afternoon, if possible, he wanted to show me one of the faces of agape. But in order for this to happen, the universe, as in the business of fishing, would have to collaborate so that everything went well. The messenger helps you, but there is one thing that is beyond the messenger's control, beyond his desires, and beyond you as well.
What is that?
The divine spark. What we call luck. When the sun had begun to set, we resumed our walking. The Jacobean route passed through some vineyards and fields that were completely deserted at that time of day. We crossed the main road, also deserted, and started again through the woods. In the distance I could see St. Lorenzo Peak, the highest point in the kingdom of Castile. I had changed a great deal since I had met Petrus for the first time near Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port. Brazil and the business deals that I had been worried about had practically vanished from my mind. The only important thing for me now was my objective. I discussed it every night with Astrain, who was becoming clearer and clearer for me. I was able to see him seated at my side any time I tried. I learned that he had a nervous tic in his right eye and that he had the habit of smiling disdainfully every time I repeated something, as evidence that I had understood what he was saying. A few weeks earlier, during the first days of the pilgrimage, I had been afraid I would never complete it. When we had passed through Roncesvalles, I had been very disillusioned about everything to do with the journey. I had wanted to get to Santiago immediately, recover my sword, and get back to fighting what Petrus called the good fight. I found out later that the term had actually been created by St. Paul. But right now, with my connection to civilization severed, what was most important was the sun on my head and the possibility that I might experience agape. We went down the bank of an arroyo, crossed the dry bed, and had to struggle to climb up the other side. An impressive river must have flowed there once, washing away the bottom in its search for the depths and secrets of the earth. Now the riverbed was so dry that it could be crossed on foot. But the river's major accomplishment, the valley it had created, was still there, and it took a major effort to climb out of it. "Nothing in this life endures," Petrus had said a few hours before.
"Petrus, have you ever been in love?"
The question was a spontaneous one, and I was surprised at my courage. Up until then, I had known only the bare outlines of my guide's private life.
"I have known a lot of women, if that's what you mean, and I have really loved each of them, but I experienced agape only with two."
I told him that I had been in love many times, but had been worried about whether I could ever become serious with anyone. If I had continued that way, it would have led to a solitary old age, and I had been very fearful of this.
"I don't think you look to love as a means to a comfortable retirement."
It was almost 9 o'clock before it began to get dark. The vineyards were behind us, and we were walking through an arid landscape. I looked around and could see in the distance a small hermitage in the rocks, similar to many others we had passed on our pilgrimage. We walked on for a while, and then, detouring from the yellow markers, we approached the small building. When we were close enough, Petrus called out a name that I didn't understand, and he stopped to listen for an answer. We heard nothing. Petrus called again, but no one answered.
"Let's go anyway," he said. And we moved forward.
The hermitage consisted of just 4 whitewashed walls. The door was open, or rather, there really was no door, just a small entry panel 0.5 meter high, which hung precariously by 1 hinge. Within, there was a stone fireplace and some basins stacked on the floor. 2 of them were filled with wheat and potatoes. We sat down in the silence. Petrus lit a cigarette and said we should wait. My legs were hurting, but something in that hermitage, rather than calming me, made me feel excited. It would also have frightened me a little if Petrus had not been there.
"Where does whoever lives here sleep?" I asked, just to break the uneasy silence.
"There, where you are sitting," Petrus said, pointing to the bare earth. I said something about moving to another spot, but he told me to stay exactly where I was. The temperature must have been dropping because I began to feel cold. We waited for almost an hour. Petrus called out the strange name several more times, and then gave up. Just when I expected us to get up and leave, he began to speak. "Present here is one of the two manifestations of agape," he said, as he stubbed out his third cigarette. "It is not the only one, but it is the purest. Agape is total love. It is the love that consumes the person who experiences it. Whoever knows and experiences agape learns that nothing else in the world is important. Just love. This was the kind of love that Jesus felt for humanity, and it was so great that it shook the stars and changed the course of history. His solitary life enabled him to accomplish things that kings, armies, and empires could not. During the millennia of Christian civilization, many individuals have been seized by this love that consumes. They had so much to give, and their world demanded so little, that they went out into the deserts and to isolated places because the love they felt was so great that it transformed them. They became the hermit saints that we know today. For you and for me, who experience a different form of agape, this life may seem terrible. But the love that consumes makes everything else, absolutely everything, lose its importance. Those men lived just to be consumed by their love. Petrus told me that a monk named Alfonso lived there. Petrus had met him on his first pilgrimage to Compostela, as he was picking fruit to eat. His guide, a much more enlightened man than he, was a friend of Alfonso's, and the three of them had together performed the ritual of agape, the blue sphere exercise. Petrus said that it had been one of the most important experiences of his life, and that even today, when he performed the exercise, he remembered the hermitage and Alfonso. There was more emotion in his voice than I had ever heard from him. "Agape is the love that consumes," he repeated, as if that were the phrase that best defined this strange kind of love. Martin Luther King once said that when Christ spoke of loving one's enemies, he was referring to agape, because according to him, it was impossible to like our enemies, those who were cruel to us, those who tried to make our day-to-day suffering even worse. But agape is much more than liking. It is a feeling that suffuses, that fills every space in us, and turns our aggression to dust. You have learned how to be reborn, how to stop being cruel to yourself, and how to communicate with your messenger. But everything you do from now on and every good result that you take with you from the road to Santiago will make sense only when you have also experienced the love that consumes. I reminded Petrus that he had said that there were two forms of agape, and that he probably had not experienced this first form, since he had not become a hermit. "You're right. You and I, and most pilgrims who walk the road to Santiago, learning the Ram practices, experience agape in its other form, enthusiasm. For the ancients, enthusiasm meant trance or ecstasy, a connection with God. Enthusiasm is agape directed at a particular idea or a specific thing. We have all experienced it. When we love and believe from the bottom of our heart, we feel ourselves to be stronger than anyone in the world, and we feel a serenity that is based on the certainty that nothing can shake our faith. This unusual strength allows us always to make the right decision at the right time. And when we achieve our goal, we are amazed at our own capabilities. Because when we are involved in the good fight, nothing else is important. Enthusiasm carries us toward our goal. Enthusiasm normally manifests itself with all of its force during the first years of our lives. At that time, we still have strong links with the divinity, and we throw ourselves into our play with our toys with such a will that the dolls take on life and our tin soldiers actually march. When Jesus said that the kingdom of heaven belonged to the children,
he was referring to agape in the form of enthusiasm. Children were attracted to him, not because they understood his miracles, his wisdom, or his Pharisees and apostles. They went to him in joy, moved by enthusiasm. I told Petrus that on that very afternoon, I had realized that I was completely absorbed by the road to Santiago. Those days and nights in Spain had almost made me forget about my sword, and they were a unique experience. Most other things had lost their importance. "This afternoon, we were trying to fish, but the fish would not bite," said Petrus. "Normally we allow enthusiasm to elude us when we are involved in such mundane activities, those that have no importance at all in the overall scale of our existence. We lose our enthusiasm because of the small and unavoidable defeats we suffered during the good fight. And since we don't realize that enthusiasm is a major strength, able to help us win the ultimate victory, we let it dribble through our fingers. We do this without recognizing that we are letting the true meaning of our lives escape us. We blame the world for our boredom and for our losses, and we forget that it was we ourselves who allowed this enchanting power, which justifies everything, to diminish. The manifestation of agape in the form of enthusiasm." I remembered the cemetery near the river. That strange, unusually large portal was a perfect representation of what had been lost. And beyond it, only the dead. As if he had guessed what I was thinking, Petrus began to talk about something that was similar. "A few days ago, you must have been surprised when I got so angry with that poor waiter who had spilled coffee on my shorts. Shorts that were already filthy with the dust and dirt of the road. Actually, I was nervous because I saw in the boy's eyes that his enthusiasm was draining away, like the blood that runs from wrists that have been slashed. I saw that boy, so strong and full of life, beginning to die, because inside him, moment by moment, agape was perishing. I have been around for a long time, and I have learned to live with these things, but that lad, with the way he behaved and with all the good things I felt that he could bring to humanity, left me shocked and sad. But I know that my anger wounded him a bit, and stemmed the death of agape. In the same vein, when you exorcised that woman's dog, you felt agape in its purest form. It was a noble deed, and it made me proud to be here serving as your guide. So for the first time in our experience on the road, I am going to participate in an exercise with you." And Petrus taught me the ritual of agape, the blue sphere exercise. "I am going to help you arouse your enthusiasm, to create a power that is going to expand like a blue sphere that encloses the entire planet, to show that I respect you and what you are doing." Up until then, Petrus had never expressed an opinion, either favorable or unfavorable, regarding the way in which I performed the exercises. He had helped me to interpret my first contact with the messenger, and he had rescued me from the trance of the seed exercise, but he had never expressed any interest in the results I had achieved. More than once I had asked him why he did not want to know about my feelings, and he had answered that his only obligation as my guide was to show me the road and to teach me the RAM practices. It was up to me whether I enjoyed the results or found them to be unpleasant. When he said that he was going to participate with me in the exercise, I suddenly felt unworthy of his praise. I knew my faults, and many times I had doubted whether he could succeed in guiding me along the road. I wanted to say all this to him, but he interrupted me before I could begin. "Don't be cruel with yourself, or you will not have learned the lesson I taught you before. Be kind. Accept the praise that you deserve." Tears came to my eyes. Petrus led me outside. The night was darker than usual. I sat down next to him, and we began to sing.
The melody came from within me, and he accompanied me with no effort. I began to clap my hands softly as I rocked forward and back. My clapping increased in its intensity, and the music flowed from me, a psalm of praise to the darkness of the sky, the deserted plateau, and the lifeless stones around us. I began to see the saints that I had believed in as a child, and I could sense that life had gotten away from me because of my having killed a great deal of my agape. But now the love that consumes returned, and the saints smiled from the heavens with the same look and intensity that I had seen in them when I was small. I spread my arms so that agape could flow, and a mysterious current of blue light began to wash through me, cleansing my soul and pardoning my sins. The light spread first to our surroundings and then enveloped the world, and I started to weep. I wept because I was re-experiencing the enthusiasm of my childhood. I was once again a child, and nothing in the world could cause me harm. I felt a presence draw near and sit down to my right. I imagined that it was my messenger and that he was the only one who could perceive the strong blue light that was entering me and leaving me, spreading throughout the world. The Blue Sphere Exercise. Seat yourself comfortably and relax. Try not to think about anything. Part 1. Feel how good it is to be alive. Let your heart feel free and affectionate. Let it rise above and beyond the details of the problems that may be bothering you. Begin to sing softly a song from your childhood. Imagine that your heart is growing, filling the room, and later your home, with an intense, shining blue light. Part 2. When you reach this point, begin to sense the presence of the saints or other beings in which you placed your faith when you were a child. Note that they are present, arriving from everywhere, smiling and giving you faith and confidence. Part 3. Picture the saints approaching you, placing their hands on your head and wishing you love, peace, and communion with the world, the communion of the saints. Part 4. When this sensation becomes strong, feel that the blue light is a current that enters you and leaves you like a shining, flowing river. This blue light begins to spread through your house, then through your neighborhood, your city, and your country. It eventually envelops the world in an immense blue sphere. This is the manifestation of the great love that goes beyond the day-to-day struggle. It reinforces and invigorates as it provides energy and peace. Part 5. Keep the light spread around the world for as long as possible. Your heart is open, spreading love. This phase of the exercise should last for a minimum of 5 minutes. Part 6. Come out of your trance, bit by bit, and return to reality. The saints will remain near. The blue light will continue to spread around the world. This ritual can and should be done with more than one person. When this is the case, the participants should hold hands while they do the exercise. The light was increasing in its intensity, and I felt that as it enclosed the world, it penetrated into every door and every back alley, touching every person alive for at least a fraction of a second. I felt my hands being held open and extended to the heavens. At that moment, the flow of the blue light increased and became so strong that I thought I was going to pass out. But I was able to keep the light alive for a few moments more, until I reached the end of the song I was singing. I was exhausted but relaxed. I felt free and content with life and with what I had just done. The hands that held mine released me. I saw that one of them was Petrus's, and I knew in my heart who it was that held the other. I opened my eyes, and there at my side was the monk, Alfonso. He smiled and said, "Buenas noches." I smiled, too, and I seized his hand
and held it tightly to my breast. He allowed me to do this for a moment, and then gently removed his hand. None of us spoke. Sometime later, Alfonso arose and continued his trek along the rocky plateau. I watched him until he was completely hidden by the darkness. Petrus broke the silence then, but he made no mention of Alfonso. Do this exercise whenever you can, and soon Agape will live once again within you. Repeat it before you embark on any project, during the first days of any trip, or when you have been greatly affected by something. If possible, do it with someone you like. It is an exercise that should be shared. So there was the old Petrus, coach, instructor, and guide, the man about whom I knew so little. The emotion that he had shown in the hermitage had already passed away, but when he had touched my hand during the exercise, I had felt the greatness of his soul. We returned to the hermitage, where we had left our things. The occupant won't be back today, so I think we can sleep here, said Petrus, lying down. I unrolled my sleeping bag, took a swallow of wine, and lay down. I was exhausted by the love that consumes. But it was a tiredness that was free of tension, and before I closed my eyes I thought of the thin, bearded monk who had sat beside me and wished me good night. Somewhere out there he was being consumed by the divine flame. Maybe that was why the night was so unusually dark. He had taken all the light of the world into himself. Death.
Are you pilgrims? Asked the old woman who served us our breakfast.
We were in Azofra, a village of small houses, each with a medieval shield embossed on its facade. We had filled our canteens at the village fountain a few moments earlier. I said that we were, and the woman's eyes glowed with respect and pride.
When I was a girl, at least one pilgrim passed through here every day, bound for Compostela. After the war, and after Franco, I don't know what happened, but the pilgrimages stopped. Someone must have built the highway. Nowadays people only want to travel by car.
Petrus said nothing. He had awakened in a bad mood. I nodded in agreement with the old woman, and pictured a new paved expressway climbing the mountains and running across the valleys, automobiles with scallop shells painted on their hoods, and souvenir shops at the gates of the monasteries. I finished my coffee and bread dipped in olive oil. Looking at Aymeric Picot's guide, I estimated that we should arrive that afternoon in Santo Domingo de la Calzada, and I was planning to sleep at the Parador Nacional. The Paradores Nacionales are ancient castles and historic monuments that have been turned into first-class hotels by the Spanish government. I was spending much less money than I had planned, even eating three meals a day. It was time for an extravagance, time to give my body the same treatment I had been giving my stomach. I had awakened with a strange feeling of being in a hurry and of wanting to be in Santo Domingo already. I had experienced the same feeling 2 days earlier, when we had walked to the hermitage. Petrus was more melancholy and quiet than usual. Was this the result of our meeting with Alfonso 2 days ago? I felt a strong need to invoke Astrain so that we could discuss the matter, but I had never summoned him in the morning, and I was not sure that I could. I decided against it. We finished our coffee and began to walk. We passed a medieval house with its coat of arms, the ruins of an ancient hostel for pilgrims, and a park on the outskirts of the village. As I once again readied myself to move out across the countryside, I felt a strong presence to my left side. I walked on, but Petrus stopped me.
There is no use running away, he said. Stop and deal with it.
I wanted to get away from Petrus and keep going. I had a disagreeable feeling, a kind of colic near my stomach. For a few moments I tried to believe that it was caused by the bread with olive oil, but I knew that I had felt it earlier in the day and that I could not fool myself. It was tension. Tension and fear. Look behind you,
Petrus's voice had an urgency to it. "Look before it's too late." I spun around quickly. To my left was an abandoned house, its vegetation burned by the sun. An olive tree raised its twisted branches to the sky, and between the tree and the house, looking fixedly at me, was a dog. A black dog. The same dog that I had banished from the woman's house a few days earlier. I forgot all about Petrus and looked squarely into the dog's eyes. Something inside me, perhaps it was the voice of Astrain or of my guardian angel, told me that if I averted my eyes, the dog would attack me. We remained that way, staring at each other for some time. Here I was, I thought, after having experienced the wonder of the love that consumes, once again, about to be confronted by the daily and constant threats to my existence that the world would always present. I wondered why the animal had followed me for such a great distance, and what it was that he wanted. After all, I was just a pilgrim in quest of my sword, and I had neither the desire nor the patience for problems with people or animals. I tried to say this to him with my eyes, remembering the monks of the convent who communicated through their eyes, but the dog did not move. He continued to stare at me without emotion, but he appeared ready to attack should I become distracted or show fear. Fear. I could sense that my fear had vanished. I thought the situation too stupid for fear. My stomach was knotted up, and I felt like vomiting, but I wasn't frightened. If I had been, something told me that my eyes would have given me away, and the animal would try to overcome me, as he had before. I did not want to avert my eyes, even when I sensed that a figure was approaching along a narrow road to my right. The figure stopped for an instant, then came directly toward us. It crossed my line of sight as I stared at the dog, and this person said something that I could not understand, in a feminine voice. Its presence was good, friendly and positive. In the fraction of a second during which the image had crossed my line of sight, my stomach relaxed. I felt that I had a powerful friend who was there to help me through this absurd, unnecessary conflict. When the figure had passed by, the dog lowered his eyes. Then he jumped, ran behind the abandoned house, and disappeared from view. It was only then that my heart began to react. The tachycardia was so strong that I felt dizzy and faint. As the scene around me spun, I looked along the road that Petrus and I had walked only a few minutes earlier, seeking the figure that had given me the strength to defeat the dog. It was a nun. Her back was to me, and she was walking toward Azophra. I could not see her face, but I remembered her voice, and I guessed that she was in her early 20s. I looked in the direction from which she had come. She had appeared from a narrow path that seemed to lead nowhere. It was she. It was she who helped me, I murmured, as my dizziness grew worse. Don't start creating fantasies in a world that is already extraordinary, said Petrus, supporting me by the arm. She comes from a convent in Cañas, 3 or 4 miles from here. You can't see it from here. My heart was still pounding, and I was sure I was going to be sick. I was too upset to speak or ask for an explanation. I sat down on the ground, and Petrus threw some water on my forehead and on the nape of my neck. I remembered that he had done the same thing after we had left the woman's house. But that day I had cried for joy. Now the sensation was just the opposite. Petrus let me rest a bit. The water brought me around, and the nausea began to subside. Things slowly returned to normal. When I felt restored, Petrus said we should walk a little, and I obeyed. We walked for about 15 minutes, but the exhaustion returned. We sat down at the foot of Arroyo, a medieval column supporting a cross. Such columns marked a number of stretches along the Jacobean route. "Your fear has hurt you much more than the dog did," said Petrus as I rested. I wanted to understand that absurd encounter. "In the life on the road to Santiago,"
Certain things happen that are beyond our control. When we first met, I told you that I had read in the gypsy's eyes the name of the demon you would have to confront. I was surprised to learn that the demon was a dog, but I did not say anything to you about it at the time. Only after we arrived at that woman's house, when for the first time you showed the love that consumes, did I see your enemy. When you chased away that woman's dog, you did not place him anywhere. You didn't hurl the spirits into a drove of pigs that was thrown over a precipice, as Jesus did. You simply chased the dog away. Now his force wanders along behind you, without a destination. Before finding your sword, you are going to have to decide whether you want to be enslaved by that force, or whether you will dominate it. My fatigue began to pass. I took a deep breath and felt the cold stone of Arroyo against my back. Petrus gave me some more water and went on. Cases of obsession occur when people lose their mastery over the forces of the earth. The gypsy's curse had frightened that woman, and her fear had opened a breach that the messenger of death was then able to penetrate. This doesn't always happen, but neither is it rare. Your confidence and your sense of mastery depend a great deal on how you react to threats made by others. This time it was I who remembered a passage from the Bible. A verse in the book of Job says, "For the thing that I greatly feared is come upon me." A threat leads to nothing if it is not accepted. In fighting the good fight, you should never forget that. Just as you should never forget that both attacking and fleeing are part of the fight. What isn't a part of the fight is becoming paralyzed by fear. I had not felt fear when the dog was there. This had surprised me, and I told Petrus about it. I could see that you felt no fear. If you had, the dog would have attacked you, and without doubt, he would have won the fight, because the dog was not afraid either. The strangest thing, though, was the arrival of that nun. When you sensed the presence of something positive, your imagination concluded that someone had arrived to help you. And this, your faith, saved you, even though it was based on an assumption that was absolutely false. Petrus was right. He laughed at me, and I laughed, too. We got up to resume our walking. I was already feeling better. "That is one thing you have to know, though," said Petrus as we moved on. "The duel with the dog will only end with a victory for you or for him. He will be back, and the next time you must try to take the fight through to the end. If you don't, his presence will worry you for the rest of your life." In the encounter with the gypsy, Petrus had told me he had learned the name of the demon. I asked him what it was. "Legion," he answered, "because he is many." We passed through fields that the farmers were preparing for sowing. Here and there some peasants operated crude water pumps in the centuries-old fight against the arid soil. Along the edge of the road to Santiago, stones had been piled into endless walls, crisscrossing the fields. I thought about how, in spite of all the centuries during which that soil had been worked, stones still surfaced, stones that could break the blade of a plow, render a horse lame, and leave calluses on the peasant's hands. It was a battle every year, a battle that would never end. Petrus was quieter than usual, and I realized that he had said almost nothing since morning. After our conversation at the medieval Royo, he had been mute, not answering any of the questions I had asked. I wanted to know more about the many demons, because he had already explained to me that each person has only one messenger. But Petrus was not interested in talking about it, and I decided to wait for a better time. We climbed a small rise, and from the top we could see the main tower of the church at Santo Domingo de la Calzada. I was glad to see it. I began to think about the magical comfort of the Parador Nacional. From what I had read about it, the building had been constructed by Santo Domingo himself as a shelter for pilgrims.
St. Francis of Assisi had stayed there on his way to Compostela. Everything about it excited me. At about 7 o'clock that evening, Petrus said we should stop. I was reminded of Roncesvalles and of the slow pace we had taken when I had needed some wine to warm me, and I was afraid that he was preparing something like that. A messenger would never help you to defeat someone else. Messengers are neither good nor bad, as I have already told you, but they have a sense of loyalty among themselves. Don't rely on your messenger to help you defeat the dog. Now it was my turn not to want to talk about messengers. I wanted to get to Santo Domingo. The messengers of people who have died can occupy the body of someone who is dominated by fear. That is why in the case of the dog, he is many. Messengers were invited in by the woman's fear, not just the murdered gypsy's messenger, but all of the many messengers who wander in space, seeking a way to establish contact with the forces of the earth. He was finally answering my question, but there was something in the way he spoke that seemed artificial, as if this were not what he really wanted to say. My instincts told me to be wary. "What do you want, Petrus?" I asked him, a bit irritated. My guide did not answer. He walked into the field toward an ancient, almost leafless tree that stood about 30 yards from us. It was the only tree visible on the entire horizon. Since he had not given me the signal to follow, I stood where I was, and I saw a strange thing happen. Petrus walked around the tree several times and said something out loud while he looked at the ground. When he had finished, he gestured for me to come over. "Sit here," he said. There was a different tone in his voice, and I couldn't tell whether it was friendliness or irritation. "Stay here. I will see you tomorrow in Santo Domingo de la Calzada." Before I could say a word, Petrus continued, "One of these days, and I guarantee you that it will not be today, you are going to have to confront the most important enemy you will meet on the road to Santiago. The dog. When that day comes, you can be sure that I will be close at hand, and will give you the strength you need to fight him. But today you are going to confront a different type of enemy, an unreal enemy that may destroy you, or may turn out to be your best friend. Death. Human beings are the only ones in nature who are aware that they will die. For that reason, and only for that reason, I have a profound respect for the human race, and I believe its future is going to be much better than its present. Even knowing that their days are numbered and that everything will end when they least expect it, people make of their lives a battle that is worthy of a being with eternal life. What people regard as vanity, leaving great works, having children, acting in such a way as to prevent one's name from being forgotten, I regard as the highest expression of human dignity. Still, being fragile creatures, humans always try to hide from themselves the certainty that they will die. They do not see that it is death itself that motivates them to do the best things in their lives. They are afraid to step into the dark, afraid of the unknown, and their only way of conquering that fear is to ignore the fact that their days are numbered. They do not see that with an awareness of death they would be able to be even more daring, to go much further in their daily conquests, because then they would have nothing to lose, for death is inevitable. The possibility of spending the night in Santo Domingo was looking more and more remote. But now I was interested in what Petrus was saying. The sun itself was dying, beyond the horizon there in front of us. Death is our constant companion, and it is death that gives each person's life its true meaning. But in order to see the real face of our death, we first have to know all of the anxieties and terrors that the simple mention of its name is able to evoke in any human being. Petrus sat down beside me under the tree. He said that he had circled its trunk a few minutes before, because it reminded him of everything that had happened to him when he had been a pilgrim bound for Santiago.
Then he took from his knapsack 2 sandwiches that he had bought at lunchtime.
"Here, where you are now, there is no danger," he said, giving me the sandwiches. "There are no poisonous snakes, and the dog will return to attack you only after he has forgotten this morning's defeat. And there are no bandits or criminals around here. You're in a spot that is absolutely safe, with one exception: the danger created by your own fear."
Petrus pointed out to me that 2 days earlier I had experienced a sensation that had been as intense and as violent as death itself, that of the love that consumes, and that at one point I had vacillated and been afraid. He said that I had been afraid because I knew nothing about universal love. He explained to me that although all of us have some idea of death, we do not see that death is only another manifestation of agape. I answered that with all my years of training in magic, I had practically lost my fear of death. Actually, I was more frightened by the way in which I would die than by death itself. "Well, then, tonight, take a look at the most frightening way to die." At that point, Petrus taught me the buried alive exercise. "You should do this exercise only once," he said. I was thinking of an exercise from the theater that was quite similar. "It is important that you be as truthful with yourself as possible, and that you be as fearful as necessary for the exercise to get at the roots of your soul. It has to strip away the scary mask that hides the gentle face of your death." Petrus stood up, and I saw his silhouette against the background of the setting sun. From where I was seated, he seemed to be a gigantic and powerful figure. "Petrus, I have one more question."
"What is it?"
"This morning you were close-mouthed and strange. You sensed before I did that the dog was going to appear."
"How is that possible?"
The buried alive exercise. Lie down on the floor and relax. Cross your arms over your chest in the posture of death. Imagine all the details of your burial, as if it were to be carried out tomorrow, the only difference being that you are being buried alive. As the situation develops in your mind, the chapel, the procession to the cemetery, the lowering of the casket, the worms in the grave, you begin tensing all of your muscles more and more in a desperate attempt to escape. But you cannot do so. Keep trying until you cannot stand it any longer. And then, using a movement that involves your entire body, throw aside the confines of the coffin, breathe deeply, and find yourself free. This movement will have a greater effect if you scream at the same time. It should be a scream that emanates from the depths of your body. "When we both experience the love that consumes, we shared in the absolute. The absolute shows each of us who we really are. It is an enormous web of cause and effect where every small gesture made by one person affects the life of someone else. This morning that slice of the absolute was still very much alive in my soul. I was seeing not only you, but everything there is in the world, unlimited by space or time. Now the effect is much weaker, and will only return in its full strength the next time that I do the exercise of the love that consumes." I remembered Petrus's bad mood of that morning. If what he said was true, the world was going through a very bad phase. "I will be waiting for you there at the Parador," he said as he prepared to leave. "I will leave your name at the desk." I watched him walk away until I could no longer see him. In the fields to my left, the peasants had finished their day's labors and gone home. I decided that I would do the exercise as soon as darkness had fallen. I was content. It was the first time I had been completely alone since I had started along the strange road to Santiago. I stood up and explored my immediate surroundings, but night was falling fast, and I decided to go back to the tree before I got lost. Before it became completely dark, I made a mental estimate of the distance between the tree and the road.
Even in darkness I would be able to see the way perfectly well, and make my way to Santo Domingo, with just the help of the frail new moon that had risen in the sky. Up until that point I had not been at all frightened. I felt that it would take a lot of imagination to make me fearful of any kind of horrible death. But no matter how long we have lived, when night falls, it arouses the hidden fears that have been there in our souls since we were children. The darker it grew, the less comfortable I became. There I was, alone in the fields. If I were to scream, no one would hear me. I remembered that I had almost passed out completely that morning. Never in my life had I felt my heart to be so out of control. And what if I had died? My life would have ended, obviously. Through my experiences with the tradition, I had already communicated with many spirits. I was absolutely certain that there was a life after death, but it had never occurred to me to wonder just how the transition was made. To pass from one dimension to another, no matter how well prepared one is, must be terrible. If I had died that morning, for example, I would have known nothing else about the rest of the road to Santiago, about my years of study, about my family's grief for me, or about the money hidden in my belt. I thought about a plant on my desk in Brazil. The plant would go on, as would other plants, as would the streetcars, as would the man on the corner who charges more for his vegetables than anyone else, as would the woman at directory assistance who provides me with telephone numbers that are not listed in the book. All these things, which would have disappeared if I had died that morning, took on an enormous importance for me. I realized that those were the things, rather than the stars or wisdom, that told me I was alive. The night was quite dark, and on the horizon I could see the faint lights of the city. I lay down on the ground and looked at the branches of the tree overhead. I began to hear strange sounds, sounds of all kinds. They were the sounds of the nocturnal animals, setting out on the hunt. Petrus could not know everything. He was just another human being like me. How was I to know if his guarantee about the absence of poisonous snakes was true? And the wolves, those eternal European wolves, wasn't it possible that they had decided to show up there that night, sniffing out my presence? A louder noise, similar to the breaking of a branch, frightened me, and my heart once again started pounding. I was growing scared. The best thing to do would be to complete the exercise right away, and then head for the hotel. I began to relax and crossed my arms over my chest in the posture of death. Something nearby made a sound. I jumped up immediately. It was nothing. The night had aroused my greatest fears. I lay down again, deciding that this time I would turn any source of fear into a stimulus for the exercise. I noticed that even though the temperature had fallen quite a bit, I was perspiring. I imagined my coffin being closed, and the screws being turned. I was immobile, but I was alive, and I wanted to tell my family that I was seeing everything. I wanted to tell them all that I loved them, but not a sound came out of my mouth. My father and mother were weeping. My wife and my friends were gathered around, but I was completely alone. With all of the people dear to me standing there, no one was able to see that I was alive and that I had not yet accomplished all that I wanted to do in this world. I tried desperately to open my eyes, to give a sign, to beat on the lid of the coffin, but I could not move any part of my body. I felt the coffin being carried toward the grave. I could hear the sound of the handles grinding against their fittings, the steps of those in the procession, and the conversations from this side and that. Someone said that he had a date for dinner later on, and another observed that I had died early. The smell of flowers all around me began to suffocate me. I remembered how I had given up trying to establish a relationship with two or three women, fearing their rejection. I remembered also the number of times I had failed to do what I wanted to do, thinking I could always do it later. I felt very sorry for myself. Not only because I was about to be buried alive, but also because I had been afraid to live. Why be fearful of saying no to someone or of leaving something undone when the most important thing of all was to enjoy life fully? There I was, trapped in a coffin, and it was already too late to go back and show the courage I should have had. There I was, having played the role of my own Judas, having betrayed myself. There I was, powerless to move a muscle, screaming for help, while the others were involved in their lives, worrying about what they were going to do that night, admiring statues and buildings that I would never see again. I began to feel how unfair it was to have to be buried while others continued to live. I would have felt better if there had been a catastrophe and all of us had been in the same boat, heading for the same abyss toward which they were carrying me now. "Help!" I tried to cry out. "I'm still alive! I haven't died! My mind is still functioning!" They placed my coffin at the edge of the grave. "They are going to bury me! My wife is going to forget all about me. She will marry someone else and spend the money we have struggled to save for all these years. But who cares about that? I want to be with her now because I'm alive." I hear sobs, and I feel tears falling from my eyes, too. If my friends were to open my coffin now, they would see my tears and save me. But instead, all I feel is the lowering of the coffin into the ground. Suddenly, everything is dark. A moment ago, there was a ray of light at the edge of the coffin, but now the darkness is complete. The grave digger's shovels are filling in the grave, and I'm alive! Buried alive! I sense that the air is being cut off, and the fragrance of the flowers is awful. I hear the mourners' departing footsteps. My terror is total. I'm not able to do anything. If they go away now, it will soon be night, and no one will hear me knocking on the lid of my coffin. The footsteps fade. Nobody hears my screams, and I am alone in the darkness. The air is heavy, and the smell of the flowers is driving me crazy. Suddenly, I hear a sound. It's the worms, coming to eat me alive. I try with all my strength to move the parts of my body, but I am inert. The worms begin to climb over my body. They are sticky and cold. They creep over my face and crawl into my shorts. One of them enters through my anus, and another begins to sneak into a nostril. Help! I'm being eaten alive, and nobody can hear me. Nobody says a word to me. The worm that entered my nostril has reached my throat. I feel another invading my ear. I have to get out. Where is God? Why doesn't he help me? They're beginning to eat at my throat, and soon I won't be able to scream. They're coming into me everywhere, through my ear, the corner of my mouth, the opening in my penis. I feel those disgusting, oily things inside me, and I have to scream. I have to get away. I am shut up in this cold, dark grave, alone and being eaten alive. The air is giving out, and the worms are eating me. I have to move. I have to break out of this coffin. God, help me gather all my strength, because I have to escape. I have to get out of here. I have to... I'm going to get out. I'm going to get out. I did it! The boards of the coffin flew in all directions. The grave disappeared, and I filled my lungs with the fresh air of the road to Santiago. My body was trembling from head to foot and bathed in perspiration. I moved a bit and felt that my insides had been twisted around. But none of this was important. I was alive. The shaking continued, and I made no effort whatsoever to control it. A great sense of calm came over me, and I felt a kind of presence alongside me. I looked over and saw the face of my death. This was not the death that I had experienced a few minutes before, the death I had created with my fears and my imagination. It was my true death, my friend and counselor, who was never again going to allow me to act like such a coward. Starting then, he was going to be of more help to me than Petrus's guiding hand and advice.
He was not going to allow me to put off until tomorrow what I should be enjoying today. He was not going to let me flee from life's battles, and he was going to help me fight the good fight. Never again, ever, was I going to feel ridiculous about doing anything. Because he was there, saying that when he took me in hand to travel with me to other worlds, I should leave behind the greatest sin of all. Regret. With the certainty of his presence and the gentleness of his face, I was sure that I was going to be able to drink from the fountain of life. The night held no further secrets or terrors. It was a joyful night, filled with peace. When the trembling ceased, I got up and walked to the pumps in the fields. I washed my shorts and put on a fresh pair from my knapsack. Then I returned to the tree and ate the two sandwiches that Petrus had left for me. They seemed like the most delicious food in the world, because I was alive, and because death frightened me no longer. I decided to sleep right there. The darkness had never been so reassuring. Personal vices. We were in the middle of a level field of wheat that stretched all the way to the horizon. The only object that stood out in the scene was another medieval column supporting a cross, one of the road markers for pilgrims. As we approached the column, Petrus stopped, placed his knapsack on the ground, and knelt down. He told me to do the same. "We are going to say a prayer concerning the only thing that can defeat you as a pilgrim after you find your sword. Your personal vices. No matter how much you learn from your master about how to handle the sword, one of your hands will always be your potential enemy. Let us pray that if you are successful in finding your sword, you will always wield it with the hand that does not bring scandal down upon you." It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and there wasn't a sound to be heard as Petrus began to pray aloud. "Pity us, O Lord, for we are pilgrims on the road to Compostela, and our being here may be a vice. In your infinite pity, help us never to turn our knowledge against ourselves. Have pity on those who pity themselves, and who see themselves as good people treated unfairly by life, who feel that they do not deserve what has befallen them. Such people will never be able to fight the good fight, and pity those who are cruel to themselves and who see only the evil in their actions, feeling that they are to blame for the injustice of the world. Because neither of these kinds of people know thy law that says, 'But the very hairs of your head are numbered.' Have pity on those who command and those who serve during long hours of work, and who sacrifice themselves in exchange merely for a Sunday off, only to find that there is nowhere to go, and everything is closed. But also have pity on those who sanctify their efforts, and who are able to go beyond the bounds of their own madness, winding up indebted or nailed to the cross by their very brothers. Because neither of these kinds of people know thy law that says, 'Be ye therefore as wise as the serpents, and as harmless as the doves.' Have pity on those who may conquer the world, but never join the good fight within themselves. But pity also on those who have won the good fight within themselves, and now find themselves in the streets and the bars of life, because they were unable to conquer the world. Because neither of these kinds of people know thy law that says, 'He who heeds my words, I will liken to a wise man who built his house on a rock.' Have pity on those who are fearful of taking up a pen or a paintbrush or an instrument or a tool because they're afraid that someone has already done so much better than they could, and who feel themselves to be unworthy to enter the marvelous mansion of art. But have even more pity on those who, having taken up the pen or the paintbrush or the instrument or the tool, have turned inspiration into a paltry thing, and yet feel themselves to be better than others. Neither of these kinds of people know thy law that says, 'For there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nor hidden, that will not be known. Pity those who eat and drink and sate themselves, but are unhappy and alone in their satiety. But pity even more those who fast and who censure and prohibit, and who thereby see themselves as saints preaching your name in the streets. For neither of these types of people know thy law that says, If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. Pity those who fear death and are unaware of the many kingdoms through which they have